Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, I'll be bringing you a Lenten reflection with well-known theologian Jesuit Father Gerald O'Collins, marking the feast of St. John of God by speaking to the Prior General of the Order of the Hospitallers of St. John of God. His name is Brother Donatus Falcon. But first, I'll be focusing on sisal, a natural fibre hardy enough to stand up to drought. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. Well, what do you associate a silk blouse or a cashmere sweater with? The rich rather than the poorer, perhaps. Yet silk and cashmere are two of the natural fibres on a long list of others highlighted during this 2009 International Year of Natural Fibres, which is aimed, among other things, at eradicating poverty. It seems at first like a contradiction, but it's not, as you'll find out by taking a closer look at this year, which was launched on the 22nd of January at the headquarters of the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations here in Rome. So in an effort to better understand, we speak to Hafez Ghanem, Assistant Director General for Social and Economic Development at this organization.
The objective of the Year of Natural Fibers is to draw attention to the importance of this sector, to its impact on poverty alleviation around the world, and to mobilize support for the development of the sector. Almost all countries produce some natural fiber: cotton, wool, flax, hemp, silk, jute, and sisal are among the most important. But there are many, many more. Production of natural fibers today is worth around $40 billion a year. And that is money that is important income for the world's farmers, especially in poor countries. For some countries, natural fibers are of major economic importance. Cotton is a major source of income in many West African countries. For example, in Burkina Faso, cotton accounts for more than half of the value of the country's exports. In Benin and Chad, it accounts for about one-third of their exports. Sisal is an important export for Tanzania, and jute is still very important in Bangladesh. In other cases, those fibers are of less significance at the national level, but are of major local importance within the countries. Here I would like to mention the case of jute in West Bengal, sisal in northeastern Brazil, and fiber from llamas and alpacas in the Andes. Millions of very poor farmers and processors in these countries depend on the proceeds from the sale and exports of natural fibers for their income and food security. And that is why we in FAO are engaged in this endeavor with you, because we feel that this is an industry that has a direct impact on the livelihoods of very poor people around the world. On the consumption side, natural fibers have a wide range of uses, from high-priced apparel to industrial applications. They are important materials in clothing and home textiles. Most of you here are wearing some natural fiber, I assume some cotton or wool or silk. Other natural fibers are used in traditional ropes and sacks, but increasingly they are finding their way into a range of newer uses, including pulping for paper and as reinforcement in plastic composites. particularly in the automotive industry. In many of these applications, natural fibers are subject to competition from synthetic substitutes. With the importance of these fibers in mind, especially for the poor farmers, as I just said, in developing countries, the FAO conference in 2005 called on the United Nations to declare 2009 the International Year of Natural Fibers. Consequently, a declaration was made by the General Assembly of the United Nations on December 20, 2006, which asked us in FAO to facilitate the observance of this year.
You may have noticed how Hafez Ghanem highlighted a natural fibre by the name of sisal. And it's about this particular fibre that I wish to focus my attention on right now, by taking you with me to the slopes of the Ozambara Mountains in Tanzania to listen to a success story relating to this fibre. The story is about Habiba, a woman in her 40s who was brave enough to replace the traditional maize she once planted on her farm with sisal, a natural fibre which today replaces asbestos and fibreglass in many composite materials. But before we listen to her story, I'd like to spare a word for those of us interested in plants about sisal. It's a hardy agave, producing some of the nature's longest and strongest plant fibres. A plant which, as you'll discover in a moment, thrives in this country's hot tropical climate, as a far-sighted German agronomist had foreseen back in 1893, when he smuggled into what was then a German colony 66 samples of this succulent plant from its native Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. But getting back to Habiba's story, it's recounted by someone who personally knows Habiba, the managing director of Katani Limited, one of this nation's leading producers of sisal. His name is Salum Shante.
My perspective comes in the form of greetings from a lady called Habiba, who is a Tanzanian sisal farmer. Habiba, a farmer in her 40s, is a single parent with four children, living in a village called Makuyuni on the slopes of the Usambara Mountains in Tanzania. She's feeling more relaxed than a number of her neighbors because she has enough food in her house. She has been able to send her two children to boarding school. She's caring for her sick mother, and she has just completed major repairs to her house. She also contributed generously to the Makuyuni Village School Expansion Fund. Her neighbors are suffering because their maize crop, which is their major economic activity, has failed again due to drought this year. But Habiba has been able to earn money because 6 years ago, she joined an outgrower scheme to grow sisal, a very drought-resistant plant, producing a tough and hard natural fiber. The rain seasons in her village have been getting very erratic. They've been getting shorter, and the land is getting drier. Therefore, having a drought-resistant crop like sisal, which also does not use expensive chemical herbicides and pesticides, is very attractive. Habiba sells her sisal leaves to the processing plant, which is run by a local company, Katani Limited, 10 kilometers away from her farm. The company provides decortication, transport, and extension services to sisal farmers who sell the leaves to produce the fiber, which is sold locally and overseas. Habiba is a member of a cooperative society of 2,100 farmers who have a 40% share in the processing plant in partnership with Katani. Habiba sends her greetings to fellow farmers all over the world who produce natural fibers. She wishes them well in this important year and joins them in urging everybody in the world to discover and support these fibers because they are good for the world environment and they change the lives of millions of very poor people who are producing them. She welcomes them to visit her in Tanzania. She hopes that she'll get the opportunity to visit them in their own countries. These are Habiba's greetings and her words, which have been delivered by me, Salum Shamte, from Tanzania.
You were listening there to the managing director of Katani Limited, one of Tanzania's leading producers of sisal. His name, Salum Shamte. And before that, we heard Hafez Ghanem, Assistant Director General for Social and Economic Development at the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations in Rome. Our thanks to both of them. And now time to mark the feast of St. John of God, which, as you probably know, the Church remembers on the 8th of March each year. For this, we join the Prior General of the Order of the Hospitallers of St. John of God, Brother Donatus Falcon, who tells me of the particular charism of this order. How would you define the charism of your particular order? Would you add an extra vow to the other three, charity, for example?
It's interesting that you should ask me that. If you had access to our literature or that type of thing, or the work that we do, you'd come to that kind of conclusion that possibly this group of people might have a fourth vow, which we have. It's called hospitality, the vow of hospitality. And really, it's the charism. It sums up who we are and what we're about. And it goes back to St. John of God himself, who was born 500 years ago, born in Portugal, worked in Spain, spent most of his life in Spain. And after his conversion...
At 40 years of age?
At 40 years. He had a conversion type of experience, which was interpreted as a nervous breakdown. It may very well have been. Nothing would change if it was a nervous breakdown, because from there on in, his whole life changed completely. Very special grace that he received, and he ended up in the dungeons of the Royal Hospital in Granada. Well, I suppose there were places in the centre of the hospital where people were treated royally, but not the mentally sick. There was a place for them in the dungeons, really, where they were chained and they were starved and beaten. And that was the treatment for a person who was considered to be mentally unstable, unwell. And John of God received that treatment. And he accepted, he was quite happy to accept the treatment that was given to him, because he felt, well, at 42, I look back and really, it was a total waste. I've done nothing. I was in the wars, I was a soldier, I was a shepherd, a bookseller. That was probably where I gained most of my position in the city of Granada as a bookseller. Most people would have known me as a bookseller. So you might say I had a little business going. That was the best that I had done so far, but really that was nothing. So to make up for my past, he was willing to accept the treatment meted out to him. But then he saw the people around him. They were chained, they were starved, they were dirty, there was only straw for a bedding. Treated worse than animals. And that really infuriated him. And he did speak with the staff that this shouldn't be the way, and of course you don't remonstrate with the people who've got the power over you. So he received a double treatment. Not only was he ill, but he was arrogant. But eventually convinced them that he was feeling better, and if they allowed him his freedom, that he would look after the sick, the others, his fellow inmates, which he did. And really there was born the Order of St. John of God, because from there on he made a commitment to himself and to his suffering brothers and sisters that when he got out of the place that he would start something. And he started a movement, hospitality. He first house, he had in different houses because they all became too small. Still, we've just received it back after 170 years in Grin, a hospital that was being planned while he was still alive. He was a part of the planning committee, which is a model hospital for the time, even for today. And 12 years later, when he died, he got the equivalent of a royal send-off, a state funeral. The entire city of Granada mobilised for his funeral and divided with each other to carry his coffin. It took hours and hours to pass a very short period of time, more than 6 hours that you'd walk in about a half a minute. Okay, so that movement started in Granada and has continued for 500 years. And we're now in 51 countries in the world. We have about 1,300 brothers and 50,000 lay co-workers who work with us. We give a lot of emphasis since Vatican II on ongoing education and formation in our philosophy and values of the order for our co-workers. And we give them not only work, but also responsibility and the executive authority to make decisions. The only person above them is the provincial. So they report to the provincial, but in the day-to-day running of the hospital or centre or service, that they are fully responsible. So we work in partnership with our co-workers. So we the resolution of the General Chapter we had recently in 2006 was that the brothers and co-workers, we are united in the mission. And the challenge for us is the transmission of the values and philosophy to the co-workers so that they will continue the work of St. John of God in the manner in which he would approve of. And that's what we're doing today.
And what we're doing today, Brother Falcon insists, is setting up houses of hospitality, houses of God. Model projects where the clinically depressed receive support and above all are kept in their own environment. Like in Malawi, for example.
In Malawi, the Order of St. John of God has set up a model service in mental health that would be the envy of any industrialized country. It has happened because of one individual who had a dream, the same as St. John of God had a dream. John of God's dream, John of God's prayer, to have a place of my own where I can bring the poor and the mentally sick and to serve them as I wish. And this brother out in Africa, an Irish brother who was in the bishop himself, he had the same dream. To do something really different, appropriate to the culture for people suffering from mentally ill. Because the mentally sick are either in chains or they're walking naked in the streets.
The sight of the mentally ill in chains or walking naked in the streets inspired this Irish brother to set up a community-based mental health service.
The whole community is involved, and it involves every aspect of the life of the community, because anything that happens in the community, there's a mental health component. If there's a drought, for example, what people are going to be anxious, they're going to be depressed, they're going to be, what are we going to do? So with our co-workers in Ireland, we have about 2,000 co-workers in Ireland, and they give a day for Africa. In other words, one day's salary for Africa. And with that, they raised about €250,000. They had some other events, but what the bulk of the money came from the salaries of the day for Africa, which the co-workers, everybody gave willingly. And the beautiful thing about it, they saw the money going exactly to what it was to relieve drought. So they, immediately there was grain, they bought grain and all that type of thing to help the families of the patients, the clients, and the co-workers. And then to say, well, okay, now everybody's been fed, but we have to look ahead. This is going to happen again. So they got the experts in, agricultural experts, who were out of work government, the Royal Malawians, they're out of work because there's no water. So they employ them to teach the local people how to sow the maize and coffee. Now there are 1,000 families who will benefit from this, and the money coming in, they have to pay back. There's no handouts. You get a loan, you help give an advice, and then you have to pay it back. And that goes into a fund. And that goes to help other families. Now, a brother from Sierra Leone heard about this idea, so he came across. And he saw, and he's gone back, and he's now helping 700 families in his area. It takes initial investment, so the Irish province and the Spanish province together have raised money to get the initial thing going, and then after that, it's self-financing. In Mental Health Week, which is in October, they have programs on the radio on mental health. They have banners around the city on mental health. The co-workers go and talk in the schools. They have conferences for community leaders, for religious leaders, ministers, priests and others, for teachers, policemen, to inform them about mental health and how to keep healthy mentally. And should somebody show some signs that there is some stress there, then to intervene, to show how to intervene. Now, instead of people being admitted, they're sending out teams. Instead of having the stigma of going to the hospital, the team comes out and intervenes at an early stage and helps the family, because if it has a breakdown takes place in the family, then the family are part of the treatment. So helps the family to help the person, their loved one, who is undergoing a difficult time, and to support that. And once you get into it, there's so many ways you can help and become involved.
It's not bring hope.
And bring hope. Oh, yes. This is the wonderful thing about it. It brings hope to people who otherwise have lost hope. And not only the people who are benefiting directly, but the wider community see what's happening. When it was being planned, the architect wants to put up a big wall. We said, no wall. No wall. This is open. We had a lot of struggle with the authorities to have it our way. It's landscaped. When the nobody else has flowers or because of lack of rain, the rain is safe when it comes in heavy. There's tanks underground. So they have green lawns and they have flowers. And it's really a magnificent place. And it has raised the whole tone of the city. And that's to do with the mental health of the people. They have other struggles going on in life, obviously, in a developing country, but this keeps them as healthy as one can. So I keep urging people, draw on the experience we've got. You don't need to reinvent the wheel. If you want to go into whatever field you want to go into, whether it's caring for the elderly, whether it's in the area of mental health, whether it's the area of learning disability, if it's the area of general medicine or hospice care, you can be sure there's some place in the world that we're doing it, we're involved in it.
After the Second Vatican Council, Brother Falcon added, "We felt the need to go back to the scriptures, back to our founder, because over the centuries we had become increasingly monastic."
It's been a struggle for us to leave that monasticism behind, that cloistered approach. Our hospitals were known as monastery hospitals. In other words, we lived with the patients. We went up and down the corridor saying our psalms to the dining room. We'd meet the patients on the corridor. And everywhere we went, we were surrounded by the people we served. And we took it as quite normal. But things have changed. The whole approach to psychiatry and mental health has changed. The whole approach to religious life have changed. So we have to demonicalize ourselves and see ourselves as apostolic religious who are sent out to the marketplaces of the world to bring the good news through caring for the downtrodden, the sick, the marginalised.
You are listening there to the Prior General of the Order of the Hospitallers of St John of God, Brother Donatus Falcon. And finally, a Lenten reflection from Jesuit Father Gerald O'Collins, Research Professor of Theology at St Mary's University College, Twickenham in England, and indeed former dean at the Faculty of Theology at the Pontifical Gregorian University here in Rome. Father Collins has written or co-written over 50 books, among these a short and snappy Introduction to Catholicism, published by Oxford University Press. But let's listen to his reflection.
Some years ago, I went to stay with a friend in New York. After a long battle with the cancer, his wife Maureen had died a few months earlier. Photographs of her, her clothes and other things made her presence in that apartment still very real. But the thing which brought her back to me most of all, and most vividly, was her breviary, the book used by priests and others for daily prayer. For years, Maureen had joined her husband in the morning and the evening to pray together the Liturgy of the Hours. The evening I arrived, her widowed husband asked me to join him in prayer and handed me her breviary. Ribbons marked the pages where she could find the appropriate hymns, the frequently used prayers like the Magnificat, and of course the psalms for the feasts and the different days of the week. When I opened Maureen's breviary and began reciting Vespers with her widowed husband, I felt as if I were entering into her prayer life and taking up the praise of God at the point when she died and went off to enjoy the face-to-face vision of God in the utterly worthwhile happiness of heaven. It was for me a lovely, special privilege to be let into the daily Liturgy of the Hours that had fed the spiritual life of a well-to-do couple in New York. Why did they commit themselves faithfully to that daily program of prayer? What kept them true to the Liturgy of the Hours for so many years? They'd come to see how beautiful and life-giving it was to join Jesus, the High Priest, in singing day by day the praises of God. That's what we do in the Liturgy of the Hours, raise our minds and voices to join together in praising and thanking our ever-loving God. Their wealth provided Maureen and her husband with many material comforts, but they knew that without their program of prayer together, they would weaken in their clear vision of what their Christian life should mean as a married couple with children and grandchildren. They knew, too, the exquisite way in which such prayer unites our personal needs with the life of the whole church around the world. The Psalms provide the Liturgy of the Hours with a deeply personal feeling. Through the Psalms, each of us can pour out our hearts to God. We praise God with joy, thank God with gratitude for what we have received, and seek help in times of trouble. Through the Psalms, we know God with our hearts rather than merely with our heads. So through praying together, Maureen and her husband enjoyed a deeply personal experience of the God whom they loved and trusted. But they also knew how they belonged to a worldwide chorus of praise. There were and are all those men and women around the world who recite or sing the Liturgy of the Hours. They share in a universal song of praise and prayer through Christ to our loving God. Why not join that choir?
Thanks there go to Jesuit, theologian and well-known author, and also long-time friend of ours here at the radio, Jesuit Father Gerald O'Collins. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening. And don't forget, we'll be back again at this same time tomorrow. So do join us then. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now.
Laudator Jesus Christus.